Welcome to PQ Doc on Call, a podcast dedicated to current and aspiring intensivists. I'm Pradeep Kamath, coming to you from Children's Healthcare of Atlanta, Emory University School of Medicine.
And I'm Rahul Domania from Cleveland Clinic Children's Hospital, and we are two pediatric ICU physicians passionate about all things MedEd in the PICU. PICU Doc on Call focuses on interesting PICU cases and management in the acute care pediatric setting. So let's get into our episode.
Welcome to our episode of a 23-month-old ex-28-week premature boy noted to have a sudden high fever and a rapidly rising end-tidal CO2 during surgery in the operating room. Here is the case presented by Rahul Domania.
A 23-month-old ex-28-week premature boy was intubated after induction with sevoflurane for a hernia repair. Almost at the end of surgery, the anesthesiologist noticed a rapidly rising end-tidal CO2 and unprovoked tachycardia out of proportion to the surgical stimulus. The patient was given a yellow medication by the anesthesiologist, anesthetic exposure was stopped, and the baby was transferred to the pediatric ICU for further management. A national hotline for management of the patient was activated and used as a guide in management of this patient. In the pediatric ICU, the patient is intubated, sedated, and chemically paralyzed. Temperature is 40 degrees Celsius, and the baby is being actively cooled using bear hugger and ice packs in the axillae. The heart rate is 170. The patient is normotensive. Although the patient is chemically paralyzed, prior to the chemical paralysis, the anesthesiologist noted rigid upper and lower extremities, as well as a clenched jaw. Labs are sent, including a blood gas, lactate, CPK, a complete metabolic panel, or CMP, and the blood gas, which comes back very quickly, shows an anion gap metabolic acidosis, as well as an elevated PCO2. The lactate on the gas is elevated. The CMP shows the serum potassium being in the high normal range, and urine is also sent for analysis and microscopy, which yields 2+ blood with no red blood cells seen on microscopy.
Excellent case, Rahul. And to summarize key elements from this case, so we have a 23-month-old ex-28-week premature boy with elevated temperature during surgery, hypercapnia with metabolic acidosis, unprovoked tachycardia, clenched jaw, all of which bring up concern for malignant hyperthermia.
Awesome, Pradeep. Well, we're going to organize this episode on malignant hyperthermia into three key buckets. Number one, pathophysiology. Then we'll go into the clinical signs and symptoms, and we'll revisit key aspects of this case. And we'll focus a large portion of this episode on the management. So Pradeep, let's go ahead and start with a short PICU board style multiple choice question. During a scoliosis repair in a teenage girl, the anesthesiologist notices a sustained elevation of the end-tidal CO2, tachycardia, elevated temperature to 40 degrees Celsius, and this is all within 30 minutes of exposure to sevoflurane. A blood gas reveals a respiratory acidosis, and the diagnosis of malignant hyperthermia is made. Anesthetic is discontinued. The surgery is stopped, and the minute ventilation is increased to 2 to 3 times normal. A national hotline is called, and dantrolene is administered. The exact site of dantrolene action in malignant hyperthermia crisis is which of the following areas? A, postsynaptic acetylcholine receptor. B, mitochondria. C, actin myosin filament of the skeletal muscle. Or D, sarcoplasmic reticulum?
The correct answer is D, sarcoplasmic reticulum. Remember, dantrolene acts inside the cell within the skeletal muscle to lessen the excitation-contraction coupling interaction between actin and myosin within the individual sarcomere. This function occurs by antagonizing the reonidin receptors within the sarcoplasmic reticulum, which inhibits the release of calcium ions vital to the contraction process.
Pradeep, that is an absolute great point. And I really want to emphasize, dantrolene is going to inhibit ryanodine receptors at the level of the sarcoplasmic reticulum.
So Rahul, what are some of the features we typically see in a malignant hyperthermia crisis?
Absolutely, Pradeep. And this is going to be very relevant, not only for board questions, but also for clinical practice. A malignant hyperthermia crisis can occur at any time during administration of an anesthetic. It could be early, within the first hour, although unlikely, can occur a little bit later. A previous uneventful anesthetic with exposure to triggering agents does not rule out the possibility of a crisis occurring during a subsequent anesthetic. A malignant hyperthermia crisis is usually going to be characterized by tachycardia, acidosis, generalized muscle stiffness or rigidity, and high body temperature originating from unleashing of the calcium from the sarcoplasmic reticulum and now having a lot of calcium in the cardiac or in the skeletal muscle myocyte is going to increase the activity of the actin and myosin filaments with their interaction being more tense. Now, what is important for us to know is that life-threatening complications in malignant hyperthermia can include cardiac arrhythmia, renal failure, DIC, and rhabdomyolysis. The anesthesiologist usually is going to notice malignant hyperthermia with two key findings. Number one, a very clenched or rigid jaw. And number two, an increase in the end-tidal CO2 accompanied with the rise in minute ventilation, especially if the patient is spontaneously breathing. If a reaction is not recognized and the metabolic hyperactivity is allowed to progress without the treatment of something like dantrolene, the key thing for us to note is that rhabdomyolysis will likely ensue. Now, there are adverse events related to malignant hyperthermia. And the key summary point that I want to emphasize here is that malignant hyperthermia is a systemic process. Patients are going to get hyperthermia, could get hypoxemia, rhabdomyolysis, hyperkalemia from the skeletal muscle having release of intracellular potassium, acidosis, as well as DIC. In extremis, a combination of hyperkalemia, hypoxemia, and sympathetic overstimulation can precipitate cardiac arrhythmias and arrest. So Pradeep, I want to really emphasize some of the triggers of malignant hyperthermia. Can you shed some light on this?
Absolutely. The triggers typically are the inhalational agents, sevoflurane, desflurane, isoflurane, and halothane, and the depolarizing neuromuscular blocking agent, succinyl chloride. In very rare circumstances, MH crisis can be triggered by vigorous exercise and heat. Now, halothane is no longer used in the U.S. Remember, more than half of the reported adverse anesthetic MH events occur in children. Typically, the incidence is 1 in 3,000 surgeries in children, as opposed to 1 in 100,000 in adult anesthetic exposures. Now, exposure to stress, heat, vigorous exercise can very rarely trigger an MH crisis in an MH-susceptible individual. So Rahul, what is basically the pathophysiology of an MH crisis in an MH-susceptible individual?
Absolutely, Pradeep. And this actually has some great parallels to basic science. I think it's important for us to understand how muscle contraction normally occurs before delving into the pathophysiology of malignant hyperthermia. During normal excitation muscle contraction, there is release of acetylcholine molecules in the synaptic cleft. Now, these acetylcholine molecules then bind to the postsynaptic nicotinic acetylcholine receptors. Activation of these receptors causes an action potential to spread throughout the skeletal muscle. And the skeletal muscle, remember, has invaginations and conduction channels known as T-tubules. Now, located within the T-tubules are voltage-sensitive dihydropyridine receptors. These undergo a conformational change in response to depolarization. So think about the T-tubules as a railway, and once the electricity goes via the T-tubules, you are going to then have a conformational change in the dihydropyridine receptors. Now, these dihydropyridine receptors are going to then activate another channel known as the ryanodine receptor. Calcium release from the sarcoplasmic reticulum is going to ensue after the ryanodine receptor is going to undergo a conformational change. So remember that the ryanodine receptor is right on the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So now the calcium release from the sarcoplasmic reticulum into the cytosol allows for calcium to freely bind to troponin C found on the thin myofilaments known as actin. And now you're going to get cross-bridging between thin myofilaments actin and the thick ones myosin. Now, muscle contraction requires energy from ATP. 40% of the energy from ATP is used for work, and the rest is released as heat. And as you note now, that malignant hyperthermia, one of the key findings is an elevated temperature, and it all goes back to this excitation-contraction coupling. Now, in health, calcium within the cytosol is rapidly sequestered via an active transport process without further consuming ATP. This reduction in cytoplasmic calcium allows the muscle cell to relax and essentially prepare for the next muscle contraction. In malignant hyperthermia susceptible individuals, there is a defect in the ryanodine receptor. I want to emphasize this point. There's a defect in the ryanodine receptor. And what was the ryanodine receptor? Well, think of it as the bodyguard on the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So in M8 susceptible individuals, there is a defect in the ryanodine receptor, which leads to uncontrolled release of calcium from the sarcoplasmic reticulum. Now, exposure to a triggering agent leads to sustained high cytoplasmic concentrations of calcium as the ryanodine receptor remains open. Think of this as a door that is just wide open, letting the calcium go into the intracellular environment of the skeletal muscle cell. Continued activation of the actin and myosin myofilaments causes a tetanic contraction of the myocyte. Now, how does this present in our patient who has malignant hyperthermia? Their extremities are rigid. Their jaw is very rigid. Also integrate the heat production. Now, remember that the heat production is sustained and widespread muscle rigidity is going to be observed. Consequently, the high demand for ATP leads to oxygen consumption and production of carbon dioxide. Remember, now you're in a hypermetabolic state, so you're going to make a lot of carbon dioxide. You're going to consume a lot of oxygen. And when oxygen supply and demand are going to be mismatched, you can get a lactic acidosis. Initially, you may see a respiratory acidosis as there is CO2 overproduction, and this exceeds the clearance capacity of the respiratory system. Eventually, oxygen demand is such that aerobic respiration is not sufficient, and lactate is produced as a result of anaerobic effort. So I really want to drive home the CO2 point here. And that is, remember, one of the early signs that anesthesiologists may notice is a rise in end-tidal CO2. So the respiratory acidosis is kind of the very sensitive and initial phase of malignant hyperthermia. Now, sustained muscle contraction comprises the structural integrity of the myocyte. And now the myocyte lyses. And that releases a bunch of various ions and molecules from the lysed myocyte. This includes creatinine kinase, myoglobin, and potassium ions. Elevated plasma concentration of these substances can lead to acute renal injury and hyperkalemia. Remember, something like myoglobin is so toxic to the proximal convoluted tubule of the nephron. Hyperthermia and rhabdomyolysis predispose to the development of disseminated intravascular coagulopathy, or DIC. So the summary here is that malignant hyperthermia, it's a rare pharmacogenetic disorder of skeletal muscle metabolism. It is inherited in an autosomal dominant manner. And in the majority of cases, the mutation is found on the gene encoding the RYR1 or ryanodine receptor gene. The calcium release is going to be uncontrolled from the sarcoplasmic reticulum, and then you get the downstream effects. So how can this practically be applied? Well, if it is an autosomal dominant type of disorder, a good history is important. If you have a patient in the PICU going to the OR, you may want to ask the family, have there been any members in the family who have had adverse reactions, for example, to anesthetics? All right, Pradeep. So we went through the pathophysiology in depth. Now, let's transition. What's the differential diagnosis of malignant hyperthermia crisis?
Rahul, that was an excellent summary of the pathophysiology of MH crisis. Going to the differential diagnosis, now the usual things that are on the list are things like sepsis, thyroid storm, pheochromocytoma, hyperkalemic cardiac arrest after anesthesia, rhabdomyolysis, and iatrogenic overheating. But three important other conditions which intensivists should really know about are, number one is the neuroleptic malignant syndrome. Now, neuroleptic malignant syndrome, or NMS, is caused by the central effects of drugs with dopamine antagonist properties, which include mostly the antipsychotics like haloperidol and the antiemetics such as metoclopramide and droperidol. Now, the onset of NMS syndrome occurs hours to days after initiation of treatment with these drugs. Clinically, a patient with NMS displays motor impairment, rigidity, akinesia, or extrapyramidal signs. Mental status can deteriorate, and coma and delirium may even develop. Hyperpyrexia is noted with dehydration and hypotension. And the duration of this syndrome can go on for 7 to 10 days. Now, the second important condition in the differential diagnosis is the serotonin syndrome. Now, toxic exposure to a single agent or multiple agents over time, or a combination of SSRIs with a MAO inhibitor, can trigger serotonin syndrome. Now, remember, serotonin is derived from the amino acid tryptophan and is metabolized in the liver by the MAO. If you use an SSRI with a MAO inhibiting drug, it actually increases the effect of the SSRI. Now, the classic triad of serotonin syndrome includes neuromuscular involvement, which can be tremor, clonus, myoclonus, hyperreflexia, and hypertonia, which is pyramidal rigidity, autonomic symptoms, fever, sweating, tachycardia and tachypnea, and change in mental status, such as agitation, excitement, and confusion. Now, there's the third condition, which I actually found in one of our PQ textbooks, is something called as malignant hyperthermia-like syndrome, or MHLS. Now, this is a condition that is actually seen without any anesthetic exposure. Now, patient may present with a type 2 diabetic coma and hyperglycemia, hyperosmolar non-ketotic state, and hyperthermia after insulin is given to them. Now, rhabdomyolysis, organ dysfunction, and hemodynamic issues can also be seen with this condition. Now, typically, this condition is seen in obese black males with acanthosis nigricans, and the exact cause is not known. Now, the hypothesis is there could be a preservative in the insulin that is used called M-crisol, or there could be an underlying previously undetected fatty acid oxidation defect, and all these factors could be contributing to this condition. The treatment for this condition is using dantrolen and supportive care as if it's an MH crisis. But important thing to stress here, Rahul, is that malignant hyperthermia-like syndrome, which is seen in these patients with type 2 diabetic coma, is triggered without anesthetic exposure. So if you're taking care of a kid in diabetic coma who suddenly develops a very high fever, you know, you may be led on to think about sepsis and all those things, which are actually correct, and that should be top on the differential, but also think about malignant hyperthermia-like syndrome, which is seen in kids with diabetic coma.
Awesome, Pradeep. I think that that is a great summary. And so, you know, I want to really emphasize the differential diagnosis. Neuroleptic malignant syndrome is a differential we must consider with malignant hyperthermia. However, the trigger is going to be different. It is going to be a dopamine antagonist. Serotonin syndrome, the trigger is going to be an SSRI or a MAO inhibitor. Remember, the key physical exam finding is clonus or hyperreflexia, and that is contrasted from the muscle rigidity that we see in malignant hyperthermia. And then the one, Pradeep, that you bring up that is so crucial for us to keep on our minds is malignant hyperthermia-like syndrome, which is going to be seen in patients in hyperglycemic, hyperosmolar, non-ketotic state. All right, before we go into management, I just want to stress here that malignant hyperthermia should be considered in any malignant hyperthermia susceptible individual who presents with an elevated CO2, unprovoked tachycardia, rising temperature that's unresponsive to acetaminophen, as well as muscle stiffness.
Rahul, if you had to work up a patient with malignant hyperthermia, what would be your diagnostic approach in this patient?
I think as pediatric intensivists, we work very closely with the pediatric anesthesiologist. So first, it's going to really rely on that discussion and the index of suspicion by both the critical care team as well as the anesthesia team. Although current diagnosis is going to be confirmed using DNA tests, the classic gold standard test for malignant hyperthermia has been cited in the literature as the caffeine halothane contraction test. Now, for this test, a provider takes a muscle biopsy and exposes the live muscle sample to halothane gas and caffeine to analyze its reaction to an anesthetic gas. Now, do we use this clinically in practice as much now? The answer is no. We go for the RYR or ryanodine receptor gene testing, but this gives you such great historical context. Although less specific at times, genetic tests are going to be used as they're relatively more non-invasive than this caffeine halothane contracture test. Now, during a crisis, I think it's important for us to send a blood gas with lactate, CPK, CMP, urine that is going to look for evidence of AKI as well as rhabdomyolysis. And I think one of the big things here is as you're sending these labs, think practically, stop the anesthetic. That's the first thing that you want to really keep in mind is stopping the anesthetic or stopping the trigger if the child is still going to have some element of anesthetics on board. Now, malignant hyperthermia susceptibility is hereditary, like we said. And remember that it is going to be passed on in an autosomal dominant fashion. Thus, children, parents, and siblings of a patient susceptible to malignant hyperthermia have a 50% chance of also inheriting susceptibility. Certain patient populations are going to be more susceptible to malignant hyperthermia, including those with central core disease, as well as some muscle diseases such as muscular dystrophy. All right, Pradeep. So just to wrap up our episode today, let's go ahead and focus on management. If our history, differential diagnosis, and further investigations lead us to malignant hyperthermia as a working diagnosis, what would be your general management framework?
So remember, MH crisis is a medical emergency that requires a rapid team approach. And you already alluded to that. Pediatric intensivists should work very closely with the pediatric anesthesiologist in helping any kid with malignant hyperthermia crisis. Now, even when it is recognized and treated promptly, MH crisis can be fatal. Those who survive can have severe brain damage, kidney failure, or impaired function of major organs, and muscle damage. Patients should be kept intubated and admitted to the pediatric intensive care unit. I typically say these kids are sick enough to place a central line and arterial line so we can get frequent blood gases and other labs that we need, as well as monitor their blood pressure. Now, most operating rooms have malignant hyperthermia carts and protocols to rapidly deal with the MH crisis. Dantrolene sodium is the drug of choice. An initial bolus of 2 to 3 milligrams per kilo is administered, and the dose is repeated until symptoms such as increased end-tidal CO2, muscle rigidity, and tachycardia resolve. This is typically followed by dantrolene that's given 1 milligram per kilo IV Q6, and very rarely infusions may be required. Now, non-pharmacologic measures that can be promptly put in place include stopping the exposure to the anesthetic, removal of the vaporizers from the anesthetic machine, increasing the minute ventilation using 100% oxygen to flush out any anesthetic and lower the end-tidal CO2, providing charcoal filters in the breathing circuit, which remove any residual anesthetic that's left in the circuit. And this should be replaced every hour of use. And then the patient should be cooled using ice packs or a bear hugger. Now, patient may need sodium bicarb if there is metabolic acidosis. Once in the PICU, the patient should be monitored for indicators of stability, such as decreasing end-tidal CO2 values, a stable or decreasing heart rate, and resolution of hypothermia and muscle rigidity. Patients are typically extubated within 24 to 36 hours. Now, in the US and Canada, there is an MS hotline, which is the 1-800-644-9737, and it can be activated to guide the management of any patient in MH crisis. Now, prior to discharge, the patient should be given a medical bracelet, information about testing, including for family members prior to any further anesthetic exposure. I would also flag the patient's electronic medical records as MH susceptible till all the tests prove otherwise. Now, appropriate counseling and testing of families thought to be at risk for MH is a critical part of the care of these patients. MH susceptibility can be associated with increased risk of heat illness, exercise-induced rhabdomyolysis, and muscle injury from statin type of drugs.
Awesome, Pradeep. And I really want to drive home some points here. And that is, number one, the use of dantrolene. Number two, making sure you recognize that there is a national hotline and your OR team has this hotline on a posted placard, probably somewhere near the front desk. Also recognizing that if you are going to have a patient with malignant hyperthermia and you're managing, work with your respiratory therapist to change the filters. Because remember, the filters will still have some residual anesthetic gas. And besides dantrolene, what was one of the key cornerstones of management? That was to stop the enticing exposure, i.e. remove the anesthetic exposure.
Rahul, as we come to the end of our podcast on malignant hyperthermia crisis, what are some of the clinical pearls or pitfalls to avoid?
Absolutely, Pradeep. I think a high index of suspicion and early recognition of malignant hyperthermia crisis is key. The anesthesiologist and the critical care team needs to be vigilant of unprovoked tachycardia, a rising end-tidal CO2, a rapid rise in temperature, as well as jaw rigidity. We also want to understand that dantrolene comes as a powder and that it is poorly water-soluble and may require substantial agitation of the reconstituted vial prior to injection into the patient. And this is really important. Remember, the dose of the dantrolene was an initial bolus of 2 to 3 milligrams per kilo. And to constitute this med, I would really emphasize you working closely with your pharmacist. Now, the patient needs to be carefully monitored in the PICU for at least 24 to 36 hours. Make sure you also understand that their end organs need to be supported as MH is a systemic disease. So to summarize our episode, malignant hyperthermia is a hereditary disease that is inherited in an autosomal dominant inheritance pattern. Patients are going to usually have a mutation in the underlying ryanodine receptor or RYR1 gene, and this is going to encode for the protein, the ryanodine receptor, that is going to be on the surface of the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And patients who are susceptible to MH, the underlying pathophysiology, is going to be uncontrolled calcium release. Now, certain patients are going to be more susceptible to MH. So think about it with your family history and also have a high index of suspicion in patients who have muscular dystrophies.
This concludes our episode on malignant hyperthermia. We hope you found value in a short case-based podcast. We welcome you to share your feedback, subscribe, and place a review on our podcast. Please visit our website, pqdoconcall.org, which showcases our episodes as well as our Doc on Call management cards. PQ Doc on Call is hosted by me, Pradeep Kamat, and my wonderful co-host, Dr. Rahul Dimenia. Stay tuned for our next episode. Thank you.